Welcome to McClanahan Academy's United States History, 1865 to the present. So this is part two of my survey course on United States history. Hopefully you've purchased part one or you've purchased a bundle and here you are at part two. But if you haven't purchased part one yet, that's okay. You can take these classes out of sequence if you want to. This course will cover essentially Reconstruction all the way up to the present. Now, I also have a separate course on Reconstruction itself. So if you're interested in just that particular topic, I've got an over 20 lecture course on Reconstruction. It's a fantastic class. In this particular class, as a survey course, we're going to do a couple of presentations on Reconstruction. We're going to look at what's happening in the broad view and from the top down, so to speak. We'll talk about Reconstruction for Black Americans later. And we'll also look at the West later. Those are a couple of things we'll talk about in later presentations. But certainly Reconstruction is a transformative event. It is the process by which the United States is recreated, not reconstructed. And so that's why I have the title of this particular presentation, Reconstruction and Recreation. Because in reality, Reconstruction means that the Union would be put back together the way it was before. So it would be the status quo antebellum. But that's not going to be the case. In fact, what we get out of Reconstruction is an entirely new United States, an American nation that's created, not the restoration of the Federal Republic. So this is the point, the pivot point in American history. And it's why I don't carry the first part of the class through Reconstruction, because Reconstruction is where everything changes. And I think if you understand that, you can understand where we are today. In fact, you could say Reconstruction carried on into the 20th century, perhaps even into 2019, as I'm recording this this particular course. Reconstruction might be an ongoing process if you look at various aspects of it, which is why in the course on Reconstruction that I have, I talk about that, how important it is to look at Reconstruction in the long view. So again, this is going to be a brief summary of some of the major points in Reconstruction. If you want some more detail, you can take that Reconstruction and Recreation course that I offer also on McClanahan Academy. So let's get started with this particular presentation. So first, we got to get through some chronology. Reconstruction begins as early as 1862, but as you can see, in 1863, Lincoln issues his Proclamation of Amnesty and Reconstruction. 1864, he comes up with what's called his 10% plan. It is also in 1864 where the Republicans in Congress come up with their own plan of Reconstruction called the Wade-Davis Bill. We know Lincoln, of course, is reelected in 64. Andrew Johnson is going to be the new vice president of the United States, which is going to be very important because Johnson will assume office in 1865 when Lincoln is assassinated. Now, this entire Johnson presidency is an interesting period, and I'm going to get into some of the things that happen. In fact, Andrew Johnson is a often maligned president, but I think unjustly so, because Johnson was simply following Lincoln's Reconstruction plan with a few even more severe modifications when he declared the South had been readmitted to the Union in 1865, December of 1865. The Republicans say, nope, I don't think so, and proceed to try to push the process of what's called military reconstruction, which we'll talk about in the next presentation. 1866, you get the Freedmen's Bureau Bill. In 1866, also the Civil Rights Act. We'll talk about those. And it's also in 1866 that the Republicans win a supermajority in the Congress, which means that no matter what Andrew Johnson does, Republicans are going to have their way. So let's talk about how all these things work out. So what is Reconstruction? Well, as I said, it's a process by which the United States was recreated. And I have some dates on here, 1862 to 1877. No, Reconstruction doesn't end in 1877. A lot of the things we're going to talk about in this course are part of a bigger picture of Reconstruction. It's the recreation of America. It's a recreation of America economically. It's a recreation of America socially. It's a recreation of America politically. America is being recreated. And the Republicans are open about this in the 1860s. But by the 1870s and 1880s, not so much. And they weren't open about it anymore because Americans rejected that. You see, Americans, it's often thought that all these progressive things that are out there, all these ideas that are floating around now today, were just part of this American revolutionary process we're going to have. We're going to change the world. Most Americans didn't think that way. And so these ideas had to be hidden because if they were open about it, no one would vote for them. But you are going to see changes on every level of society and in every part of the United States, not just the South, but also the North and the West. The whole union, now nation, in quotation marks, because that's what we get. We get a national government out of this, is affected by Reconstruction and Republican Party policies. The Republican Party is driving all of this. They are the movers and shakers in Reconstruction, not the Democrats, but the Republicans. Now, what we get is a changing union from Republic to Empire. Economic Reconstruction, the central government promotes industry, commerce, and finance. This is the Hamiltonian or American system. If you took the first half, we talked about the American system. We're going to get that through Reconstruction. It becomes the dominant, ascendant economic system. And so if it's not for Reconstruction, we don't have that particular system in America. You get political and governmental consolidation, the centralization of power in Washington, D.C., and a loss of federalism or state power. So those things are going to disappear because of Reconstruction, a loss of federalism or state power. We get an aggressive foreign policy and the spread of American liberty and democracy abroad, and we get our progressive America. So we'll talk about imperialism in a couple of units, but that's certainly part of Reconstruction. So you can't really talk about Reconstruction and understand it without understanding that it's going to affect virtually everything in America. Not just the South. Not just social conditions in the South. But economic conditions, political conditions, cultural conditions, yes, social conditions, but also foreign policy. So this is a huge issue. That you can't just put into a neat little package and say 1862 to 1877 like historians try to do. But the important thing to know about it, of course, is that this is North over South. Once the South was, quote-unquote, out of the Union in 1861, the North could operate the general government with little interference. Now, the North would say the South was never out of the Union. The South, of course, would say they were out of the Union. I believe they were out of the Union. But the way the North is going to treat the South is that they weren't out of the Union. We are going to get the loss of the agrarian order in the United States, and Northern ideology is going to dominate. The South is really unable to mount a lasting opposition to Reconstruction or the transformation of the United States after returning to the Union in 1865. So you get the Northern view of the war, the Northern view of history, Northern economics, Northern mythology, Northern culture is going to dominate, literature, art, values. If the war doesn't happen, none of those things in that list happen. Because the North has the ability to write the history because they won the war. Now, the Republican economic agenda is interesting. You get the creation of a national bank through the National Banking Acts of 1863 to 64. You get the fusion of government and finance. You get the promotion of industry through protective tariffs. You get land grants to the railroads. This is the origin of the Gilded Age. You get income taxes and greenbacks, which creates inflation. So the Republican economic agenda was big banks, big business, big tariffs, big spending for that time. I wish we could have the budget they had in the 1860s. Be a lot smaller than it is today. And to the West and the South, the congressional policy was simply retribution. The South had to be punished for her sins, and it's often said the South was punished with poverty. There was tremendous economic and physical dislocation after the war. Tremendous economic and physical dislocation after the war. And there's a high personal cost. The number of men that were wounded in the South, and when you're wounded in the South and you're a farmer, you can't go farming if you don't have an arm or a leg. So it makes for a very difficult time for Southerners who are engaged in this type of work to go back to work when they're an invalid, when they have one arm or one leg, or no arms or no legs. The Union Army, of course, will wage war on the American Indian tribes in the West. This is where William Tecumseh Sherman famously said, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And there will be a massive war against the Indian tribes in the West when Americans want to keep expanding out there. And you also get a changing social order in the United States. The role of minority groups in America is heightened. So this is where you get the new United States for Black Americans. How new was it, though? The question is, I mean, was there some type of new South or, you know, for Black Americans or for other Americans? Was there a new South for these people? Did they undergo the same type of transformation? I mean, this is a question historians have been asking for a very long time. Now, almost 400,000 Southerners are killed during the war. Killed and wounded, I should say. 75% of the white Southern population fought in the war. Perhaps as 90,000 black Southerners served the Confederacy in some capacity. There's this myth of regiments of black Confederates marching out. I deal with this in my War for Southern Independence course, if you want that. But Atlanta, Richmond, Charleston, South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, all Columbus, Georgia, all burned by the war. The infrastructure was destroyed. Railroads and bridges were destroyed. Homes, businesses, farms, industries, all these things were destroyed. So the poverty that comes with this, the punished with poverty, affects the entire Southern population, not just white Southerners. This is a war, again, that's going to, in a process, that's going to radically transform America. Now, there was Southern economic and political distress. Confederate money and bonds were worthless. The land that was there was heavily taxed. Enslaved property was lost to abolition. And so that takes a lot of capital out of the embargo. And we can say that the ending of slavery was good, but what that's going to do economically is, of course, destroy the South economically. Major trader centers were damaged or destroyed by the war. The South was the only place in the world, it was said, where people build chimneys without houses because of all the homes that were burnt out. Many white Southerners were denied the voter the ability to hold office at some point after the war. So this is a really uncertain future. Depression marked the face of every Southerner. And this period used to be called a tragic era. Now, it's celebrated as an unfinished revolution, something that should have, the South deserved more than what they got here. But the South was terribly punished by this particular war and Reconstruction. Now, early Reconstruction efforts, of course, began with Abraham Lincoln when he took office again for a second term in March of 1865. He said, "With malice toward none, with charity for all, let us strive to bind up the nation's wounds." And when he was asked what to do with the South, he said, "We're going to let them up easy." When he was asked what would happen with the former slaves, he said, "They can root hog or die," something that Lincoln is often not criticized enough for. But Lincoln was not really interested in this theoretical issue of slavery. Lincoln was a pragmatist. He was a politician, not much of a statesman. And when he was pressed on the issue of slaves, former slaves, Lincoln was fine. They can just root hog or die, and they can. We'll talk about what happens with former slaves, and when we do our two units on civil rights, and we'll get into some of these things in more detail. But let them up easy was what he initially said, and that was Lincoln's policy for the most part. I think that generally it's considered that if Lincoln had survived being shot in the head, or if he wasn't shot in the head, Reconstruction would have been different. But as it stands, Lincoln is killed, and so things change. Now, 1863, you get the Proclamation of Amnesty and Reconstruction, which leads to what's known as the 10% Plan. Essentially, he allows anyone who's not a high-ranking politician or military officer to take an oath of allegiance to the United States, and all is forgiven. And if 10% of the 1860 voting population in the South in every state took that oath of allegiance, well, the state is considered back in the Union. This is a very lenient plan of Reconstruction. Lincoln wanted to resume the Union as quickly as possible. So in his mind, this is resumption rather than Reconstruction. There's a legal reasoning for this, because Lincoln always maintained that the South was not really out of the Union. They were just in rebellion. So they're going to resume their status in the Union. If they're out of the Union, then he would have had to have a declaration of war, something he did not have. And so Louisiana, Tennessee, and Arkansas were back in the Union by 1864. So the Republicans in Congress are not happy about this very lenient plan of Reconstruction, so we get the Wade-Davis Bill of 1864. This is the radical reaction to Lincoln's soft approach to the South, and it required an ironclad oath that the individual never supported the Confederacy, Now, 75% of the white Southern population fought in the war. And so, and then, of course, probably close to 90% of Southerners supported it in some manner. And so if you're saying that they never supported the Confederacy, that means maybe 10% of the Southern population could take that oath. But the way Davis Bill required 50% of the voting population to take the ironclad oath before they could be admitted to the Union. Well, this is a pipe dream. It's not going to happen. So Lincoln pocket vetoes the bill. Means the Congress passes it. He sticks it in his pocket. He doesn't sign it. And, of course, Congress adjourns before the 10-day requirement that he has to sign the bill. And so it's like it never happened. But this really sets the stage for the conflict between the moderate Republicans and the radical Republicans. Now, again, April 1865, Lincoln's assassinated in Washington, D.C. John Wilkes Booth pulls the trigger, and this changes the course of Reconstruction. The battle between the executive branch and the Congress will intensify, and that's because Andrew Johnson will become president of the United States. He's the 17th president of the United States, serves from 1865 to 1869. Johnson was a war Democrat. He was not a Republican. He was from Tennessee. He was a Southerner. And Johnson was very critical of the South during the war. He said that, you know, the large plantation owners who he thought led this cause of secession should be hung. He wanted to punish the South, but there was a certain belief that this would happen. But Johnson was a wild card. Now, there's all kinds of disparaging things that have been written about Johnson. One, that he was imbibing too much liquor when he was went through his inauguration. He was too inebriated to be able to make a speech, and so they pulled him down. And Johnson was seen as kind of a hayseed, rough around the edges. This is the perception that you get of Andrew Johnson. The Republicans in the North were driving that perception of Andrew Johnson. But of course, they thought that with things that Johnson had said during the war, that this was going to be a slam dunk. Johnson was going to pursue the radical policy of Reconstruction. It just wasn't going to happen that way, because by December 1865, Andrew Johnson declares that the Union has been restored. All the Confederate states except Texas send delegates to the United States Congress. Now, the Congress, as per their right, refuses to seat these individuals. But he essentially followed through with Lincoln's Reconstruction plan with some greater restrictions on some former high-ranking Confederate officials. But the battle with Congress really begins here. Congress does not want Johnson's Reconstruction plan. They didn't want Lincoln's Reconstruction plan, and now Johnson, with less political capital than Lincoln, is going to be skewered over this. Now, there is a belief that had Lincoln survived, that Reconstruction would have gone in a different direction, that Lincoln would have tried to create this conservative party of maybe some old Whigs, some conservative Democrats. They would have tried to outflank the radical Republicans and control Reconstruction. That might have happened. Lincoln had more political capital, but it's not certain that this would have happened, because the radicals were bent on punishing the South. So Johnson's Reconstruction plan is rejected by the radical Republicans in Congress. They form what's called the Joint Committee on Reconstruction, and they believe, they argue that they alone have the power to legislate and handle Reconstruction. Several high-ranking Confederate officials in the Confederate government were refused seats in the Congress, including the former Vice President, Alexander H. Stephens. So the question is, who were these radicals that were going to drive Reconstruction? They're putting the brakes on this very lenient, with malice toward none, let them up easy policy of Reconstruction. So there are people like Thad Stevens, the great commoner of Pennsylvania, wealthy industrialist and lawyer who owned several large iron foundries and made a lot of money on the war on railroad contracts. He was an abolitionist, member of the House of Representatives, and he said the southern states were conquered provinces to be dealt with by the Congress. Or Charles Sumner of Massachusetts, the radical Republican and abolitionist senator who was knocked unconscious by Preston Brooks. He said secession meant reverting to territorial status in a very long history of anti-Southern rhetoric before the war. So you have the conquered provinces, you have territorial status. These are pretty vicious things to say. Then you have Benjamin Wade of Ohio, the radical Republican senator, the co-author of the Wade-Davis Bill. He believed that slaves should be armed, Southern property should be confiscated and Confederate leaders should be executed. He was instrumental in the Johnson impeachment process. He's also very racist, and I'm not going to use the language he would use, but he really didn't care for black Americans whatsoever. He was an abolitionist, but he wasn't someone who really appreciated the status of black Americans, North or South. Now, in 1866, many of the former Confederate states are going to pass what are called the Black Codes. These are similar to laws against free blacks in Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. They were aimed at preventing vagrancy. They prohibited interracial marriage. They established a master-servant relationship by law. And they allowed Northern leaders more than anything to chastise the South, and they led to radical Republican attacks. But when you use that term vagrancy, there's the Supreme Court actually will rule at one point that vagrancy, you can't pass laws against vagrancy. And what was happening, as would be natural, is that former slaves were testing their freedom. They were moving around. They were following the Union Army primarily, but they weren't working as much. And so Southern states started saying, well, look, we need people to work. So if you're just, if you can't show that you're doing anything, we're going to put you on a plantation. Essentially, this was, it was going to establish a master-servant relationship. It's another form, it was argued, of slavery. But again, these were laws that were very similar to what states like Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio had. In fact, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio did not allow blacks even to live in those states at one point. So the South was wondering, well, what the heck here? We're doing the exact same thing that y'all are doing up there. Why are we getting vilified for it? Well, it's because of votes. So it's all about power, ultimately. The Republicans will pass a couple of very important pieces of legislation in 1866, the Freedmen's Bureau Bill and the Civil Rights Act. The Freedmen's Bureau Bill is designed to enforce the 13th Amendment. And we'll talk about the 13th Amendment later, but this is all about votes. It sets up schools for former slaves. The idea was to get former slaves educated and get them voting. And there's a lot of money that's being dumped into the South, at least theoretically, but not really. In fact, the South is being required with very little revenue to prop up these schools and do the heavy lifting in providing the funds for these schools, and they don't have it. But even the Freedmen's Bureau money wasn't really enough that was there to do much of this stuff. So the South was having to foot the bill, which you could argue is a form of reparations. The Civil Rights Act granted freedmen citizenship and allowed former slaves to own property and sue in court. The two things that they thought were essential to protecting freedmen in the South. This is exactly what the 14th Amendment is going to do, and the 14th Amendment was only designed to do that. Citizenship meant that you could own property and you could sue in court. That was it. Now, Johnson's going to veto both pieces of legislation. He declares they're unconstitutional, a violation of state powers. Congress will then just override his veto. And both pieces of legislation become law in 1867. He was right about this. Look, neither one of these pieces of legislation were constitutional at the time. Legally, he was correct. Which this becomes a major issue in 1866. And so the Republicans are going to campaign on, look, we need to reconstruct America. We need to reconstruct the South. We need to punish the South, essentially, is one of their messages. And the Republicans will rout the Democrats and control over 75% of the congressional seats, which is a supermajority. The South was still not represented in Congress. And this is really the beginning of what's called congressional or military reconstruction. And we'll have to talk about that in the next presentation. So I will see you for presentation